This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Silent Child, written by Sarah A. Denzel and read by Joanne Froggatt. Chapter 1. The day I lost Aiden was the day I realized what it meant to lose control. People talk about losing control of themselves all the time, whether it's from drink, drugs, passion, or anger. But they don't know what it's truly like to lose control, and I'm not talking about my emotions, but about my life. I lost control of my life. Everything around me fell apart while I remained the impotent bystander. I've heard it said that you can only control yourself and how you behave in any given setting. You can never control the circumstances around you. You can't control how other people react, only how you yourself act. That's the great tragedy of life. One moment, everything is perfect, and the next, it's all in tatters because of what's happening around you. And what are you supposed to think when your child is taken from you? That it was fate? God? Bad luck? How are you supposed to move on? When it comes to the birth lottery, I lucked out. I was born in the kind of bucolic loveliness that lulls you into thinking nothing bad will ever happen to me. Guns and violence may litter the news, but nothing like that ever happened in Bishop Town on Ouse. We were nestled in the sweeping landscape of a John Constable painting, with long stretches of rolling green pastures and dry stone walls. We were safe. At least I thought we were. On the 21st of June 2006, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I donned a great waterproof coat and a pair of Wellington boots and stepped out into the worst flash flood that Bishop Town on Ouse had seen since 1857. The cottage I shared with my parents and my 6-year-old son, Aiden, was set slightly back from the quiet street. As I stepped outside that day, the stream of water took me by surprise with its strength. It splashed up my wellies and spattered across my crotch. My heart had already started to quicken because I was worried about getting to the school. The teachers had rung round all the parents asking them to collect the children because the rain was getting through the roof at school, and there was a danger that the banks of the Ouse would burst. We had known about the torrential rain, but no one had predicted this. It fell in a sheet from above, relentlessly soaking my face and battering the hood of my Caramore jacket. The Ouse twisted through our tiny village like a boa constrictor through a sandbox. It was picturesque and pretty, this too big river in our tiny town. Bishop Town had 2 pubs, a B&B, a church, a school, and a population of around 400 people. It was the second smallest village in England and the smallest village in Yorkshire. No one moved out of Bishop Town and no one moved in. If a house went up for sale, it was because someone died. We all knew each other. We grew up together, lived together, raised our children together. So when the phone rang and Amy Perry, a teacher at the primary school and one of my old school friends, told me to pick Aiden up, I knew the situation was bad. Otherwise, Amy would have walked the children back to each and every house in the village. That was how much we trusted each other. I'd heard the rain drumming on the windows, but I'd been lost in my own world yet again, looking at MySpace photos of my school friends who had been to uni and since gone travelling. I was 24. I'd finished my A-levels with Aiden in my belly and watched my friends leave for university with the world at their feet while I remained in my parents' house. I saw some of them leaving for new pastures as I gazed down at the bus stop from my bedroom window, one hand on my swollen stomach. Since that moment, I had spent more time than was healthy Googling my friends on the internet, opening pictures of Thailand and Paris while I nursed a baby. There was no way I could drive in this weather, and I was the closest to the school out of my family, so I decided to walk there. Rob, Aiden's father, was working on a construction site outside York. My parents had their own jobs too. They would be too far away to help, trapped by the weather. I didn't call any of them right away because I didn't think I needed to. Bishoptown was a small place and it would only take me 10 minutes to walk to the school. But the school building was also on the other side of the ooze, which did worry me slightly. If the rain was as bad as the news suggested, the river could burst its banks. I trudged up the road through the rainwater, my heart beating a rapid tattoo against my ribs. The slanting rain made it difficult to keep my eyes open as I walked against it. I lowered my head and gripped the strap of the bag over my shoulder, my hands already soaked and cold to the bone. Emma? The voice was only just audible above the hammering of the rain on the tarmac. I turned around to see my friend Josie waving to me as she hurried up the hill in my direction. She was an accountant at the small firm where I worked part-time as a secretary. It jolted me to see her so disheveled, her hair plastered to her head and makeup running down her face. She had no coat, no umbrella. Her pencil skirt was soaked through. Joe? Jesus, get inside! Emma, I've just been across the bridge. The banks are breaking. You need to go home. Oh, fuck, I have to get Aiden from school. They'll keep him safe, she said. But if the river bursts and you're close to the bridge, you could drown. She waved me towards her, but I stayed where I was. I have to get Aiden, I said, shaking my head. The school was too close to the river for me to feel comfortable leaving my 6-year-old son there. If the rain was already coming through the roof, what state was the building in? Be careful. I heard they're sending help, but there's hardly anyone by the river right now. No police or anything. And it looks bad, Em. Don't come back across the bridge, okay? Go to the White Horse or something. At least you can get a Chardonnay there, right? She grinned at the joke, but I could tell it was a nervous smile. She was genuinely shaken up, which wasn't like Josie at all. All right, get home safe. I'll see you at work when this bloody weather has calmed down a bit. I returned the nervous smile, trying to ignore the nest of snakes in my abdomen. My dad had volunteered in the Royal National Lifeboat Institute when he was younger, and he had always told me that if there was one thing in life you did not mess with, it was the sea. Our tiny bit of the sea gushed through Bishoptown today. When I reached the bridge, the sight took my breath away. Josie was right. The ooze was dangerously close to bursting its banks. Usually tranquil and slow, the river surged beneath the bridge, hitting the stone arches in waves. The water seeped up onto the sodden grass banks, and some of it dribbled down the hill towards my parents' cottage. I took a step back and pulled out my mobile phone. There was no answer at the school, which did not assuage my worry. I phoned Dad next. Emma, are you all right? He asked. I'm at the office and the rain is so bad I think I'll be stuck here. Don't try to get home, Dad. The river might burst. Dad worked just outside Bishoptown as a civil engineer for a construction firm. I'm going to the school to stay with Aiden until help arrives. Emma? I'm fine. Just don't try to come home, okay? Emma, the bridge... I eyed the short stone bridge with trepidation. I'm already past it. I'm on my way up Acker Lane to the school. I lied. He let out a sigh of relief. I'll call your mother and tell her to stay at the surgery. Okay, Dad. I love you. Love you too, kiddo. It was silly, I know, but my eyes filled with tears as I cancelled the call. The time on my phone said 2:10 p.m. It had taken me 10 minutes to walk just half the way. I needed to hurry up and get to my son. I strode up the bridge and tried to ignore the water level, hoping that my hurried strides would somehow make it less dangerous. Water poured across the bridge almost ankle deep. I didn't know if it was rainwater or water that had come from the river or a combination of both. The only thing I knew was that I had to hurry up. But as I took the last step down off the bridge, a wave of river water hit the bridge hard and chunks of stone dislodged, crumbling beneath my feet. It sent me off balance and I stumbled forward, dropping my phone into the river. My breath left my body as the freezing cold water hit me side on, almost knocking me straight into the churning waters. I took a long sidestep like a crab, feeling the current trying to drag me along with it. But the riverbank was soft and muddy, which allowed me to ram the heel of my welly deep into the earth. The suction gave enough of a foothold that I could propel myself forward, clawing my way up the riverbed. My left boot came clean off. With my sock dangling from my foot, I climbed my way up to the road, gasping for air as the rain pounded from above. When I was away from the bridge, I turned around and watched my boot slip under the water. I tried to find my breath, soaked down to my bra. That could have been me. And then who would be there to take Aiden home? No, I wouldn't be bringing Aiden home. Not with a river like this. I'd have to stay with him at the school. What an idiot I'd been. I'd ignored my dad's warnings about water. A hard lump formed in my throat as I turned my back on the river. One misstep and I would have fallen into the same water as the stones, my phone, and my Wellington boot. One mistake and I would have been floating beneath the current where the water is calm, my hair gliding around me, an ethereal water nymph who would never breathe again. Another dead young woman. A statistic in a tragic flooding incident. A selfish woman who left her 6-year-old son motherless after lying to her father. I shook my head and made my way up Acker Lane like I had just told Dad. The road followed the direction of the river for a mile before turning left onto the school road. The school road carried on for another half a mile before coming to the car park of Bishoptown School. I noticed that the water had pooled in the car park, where it was halfway up the tyres of some of the cars. There was little chance of all these people making it home for the night. I turned my attention back to the school. It was my school, too, where I'd carved my name into the floorboards in the assembly hall to impress Jamie Glover, a boy who would later break my heart by kissing Fiona Carter on the rugby pitch in secondary school. But this time, of course, it was my son's school. It was his time to make memories and carve his name into wood using the sharp point of a compass. It was a small Victorian building, built like a modest church, with steep gables and old-fashioned leaded windows. There was more than a hint of the Gothic about it. Dragging my soaked sock, I ran to the entrance and let myself in, almost tripping over someone in the doorway. When I straightened up, I realized it was Mrs. Fitzwilliam, the same woman who had been headteacher when I was a child. When she saw me, her face paled, and her gaze moved from my eyes to somewhere above my head. There was something about the change in her countenance that made my stomach drop to my sodden feet. "What is it?" I asked. A dribble of rainwater trickled down the wall behind Mrs. Fitzwilliam. We'd called her Mrs. Fitz when I was a child. She had always been firm but fair. We were a little afraid of her red hair, but it was almost completely grey now, and her stern expression was softer as she finally met my gaze. The tears in her eyes forced my heart to resume into its tattoo against my ribs. I clutched hold of my chest, trying to calm myself, while my heart seemed to have been restarted with defibrillators. "Miss Price, Emma, I'm so sorry." I took a step forward and she took a step back. Her expression told me that mine was wild. She put both hands up in front of her as if in surrender. "We've called the police and they'll be here soon." "Tell me what happened," I demanded. "Aiden slipped away. Miss Perry was with the children in Classroom 4. She was performing a head count. We had collected all the children from Year 2 in that classroom because the roof leak wasn't as bad. But somehow Aiden left the classroom. We've searched the premises and we believe he has left the school." I clutched my chest in a pathetic attempt to alleviate the pain that radiated from my heart. "Why would he leave?" She shook her head. "I don't know. Perhaps he was curious about the rain." I crumpled in on myself, folding over like paper. Of course he was curious. Aiden was curious about everything. He was an explorer. He climbed trees in the park. He scurried over 5-bar gates into fields filled with cows. He hid in the heather on the moors around Bishoptown and played hide-and-seek in the forest. I had nurtured that side of him. I wanted a wild, brave child. I wanted that for him. I wanted him to grow into a strong man with a penchant for exploring. I'd pushed my wanderlust onto him. But I hadn't wanted this. I hadn't wanted him to wander away from safety during the most dangerous flood in over 100 years. "You've searched the school?" I asked. "We're still looking," she said. I'll help. The rest of that day was a blur. I checked each classroom myself, tipping over buckets placed under leaks and snatching open cupboard doors, screaming his name until I scared the other children. It was no use. Aiden was not in the school. I'd searched every nook and cranny of the school, even trudging around the car park and the football field. Eventually, Amy got me to sit down and Mrs. Fitzwilliam brought me hot coffee. The police showed up hours later, along with search and rescue. Somehow, amongst all that, I'd been given an extra pair of shoes. No one had found Aiden. There was so much for the authorities to deal with. Search and rescue and the police were stretched so thinly that my boy, my missing boy, stayed just that. Missing. And now, do I resent that? Do I hate the parents whose children were taken to safety in boats and helicopters as the ooze finally burst and covered our small village in its murky lifeblood? No, I can't. I can't begrudge the men and women who worked tirelessly to help the living. But as I watched everyone moving around me, watched the rest of the children reunited with their parents, and watched the half-drowned people of my village receive blankets and hot cups of tea, I realized that my life was no longer in my own hands. On that day, when I lost Aiden, I lost all control of my life. And with him gone, I would never get it back. Chapter 2. All that wasted potential. That was the phrase I heard over and over again when I fell pregnant with Aiden in year 13 of school. I had just turned 18 when I pissed on the stick and had already sent my UCAS application to several universities, universities that I had expected to accept me to their humanities courses. However, Rob, my boyfriend at the time, had not applied to any universities. He was hanging on by a thread, and when I announced my news, the thread finally broke. Rob was never the kind of boy you took home to your parents. He was in a band at 15, tattooed at 16, and almost completely gave up on school at 17. He had stayed on at Bishoptown School to do his A-levels, but when I look back on that time now, I wonder if he'd stayed to hang out with me more than anything. We were very much in love. But it was young love, passionate and idiotic, full of mistakes and drama. The biggest drama was my pregnancy, which prompted a family meeting between the Prices and the Hartleys to discuss what should be done about the whole ordeal. At one point, I wondered whether they might send me away somewhere for 9 months to have the baby in secret. It all suddenly seemed like the early 20th century, not the early 21st. This was a small village of rich, rural people. My mother was the general practitioner for Bishoptown. Rob's family owned the boutique B&B in the village and several holiday cottages outside York. We were supposed to have a future. We were middle-class children whose parents had worked hard for our future, and we'd pissed it all away like I'd pissed on that stick. I could have had an abortion, and believe me, I considered it. Mum even sat me down and described the procedure in a calm and neutral way. Girls like me often choose that route. It's often what they feel is the best decision for them. But there was something about that little bean I saw on the ultrasound scan that made me wonder whether there was a little magic growing inside me. I had the magic bean forming in my womb, and I wanted to see how it would all turn out. Maybe there was some selfishness to my decision. Maybe there is some selfishness to every decision. But that was my choice. My choice was Aiden. And I never regretted it. Not when he split open my skin coming out of me. Not when he screamed bloody murder instead of taking a nap. And not when they found his red coat floating in the river ooze 3 days after the flood. No. I never regretted my choice. Not even 7 long years after the flood when I finally, officially, had my son declared legally dead. Emma, do you want to open this one? I blinked, found myself back in the teacher's common room, sat on the not-so-comfy chairs that had been arranged round a small coffee table. The left wall was covered by teacher's pigeonholes, and behind me was a small kitchen area with a few cupboards containing old cereal packets and a sink filled with mugs and teaspoons. How long had I been thinking about Aidan? From the looks on the faces around me, I'd not been paying attention for a while. Sure, sorry, I was miles away. I tucked a strand of loose hair behind my ear and bent my head as I smiled and took the present from Amy's outstretched hand. 10 years ago, when Aidan died in the flood, I would never have imagined that I'd be working with a woman who allowed my son to wander out of school. But life moves on and people evolve. Despite everything, I forgave Amy for that day. She'd been stretched beyond her capabilities during the flood, and when her back was turned, my son did the improbable. He walked straight out of school, down to the dangerous river, and got caught up in the current and drowned. Those are the cold, hard facts. But whenever I thought of them, I disconnected myself from the reality of them. Sometimes I wondered if I disconnected from Aidan's death completely. I wondered if I really believed he was dead, not just living like a wild thing on the Yorkshire moor somewhere, frightening hikers by jumping out from the heather and then scampering off to a cave to live like Stick of the Dump. I pushed my thumbnail under the sellotape and slowly peeled open the present on my lap. It was wrapped in a pink ribbon with pink wrapping paper of birds and flowers. The paper was thick and hard to tear. Amy hadn't just nicked the newsagents from Bishoptown Hill for this. She'd gone to Paper Chase or Waterstones for such pretty and trendy paper. Beneath the birds was a box with a clear plastic front. Oh, it's beautiful, I exhaled slowly, holding back the tears pricking at my eyes. Is it okay? She asked, a quaver of anxiety evident in her voice. I know some mums don't like people getting such girly presents for their babies, but I saw it and it was so gorgeous that I just had to. I met her watery gaze with my own. I'd known Amy since I was 13 or 14, though we'd never been close. She was someone who would hang around in the same circles as me, but not someone I would call on a Saturday night for a veg out and movie night. She had always been somewhat mousy and would have been pretty if it hadn't been for the long front teeth that prevented her mouth from closing completely. She had something of a stereotypical librarian demeanour about her. She was quiet, uneasy, and awkward with most people, and I knew Aidan's death had weighed heavily on her mind all these years. Eventually, after my crippling grief had slowly faded, I'd ended up feeling sorry for her. Oh, it's lovely, cooed Angela, head of Year 7. Pretty, said Samara from the English department. Oh, I want to go back to being a girl and get one myself, said Tricia, the other school administrator. I looked down at the doll resting on my lap and tried hard to push the memory of Aidan out of my mind so that for once, just once, I could think about my future. It had been hard this decade. Harder than I'd ever imagined life could be, but it had not been completely filled with misery. There had been beautiful moments, like marrying Jake and finding out I was pregnant with his child. This should be another happy moment, and I wanted to enjoy it. I wanted to live in the present. So I pushed Aidan out of my mind while saying a silent apology and thought of the day I would give this beautiful doll to my daughter. It was made from porcelain with delicate pink cheeks and wavy brown hair that fell to its shoulders. It wore a pink tulle dress with daisies stitched along the hem and a butterfly on the shoulder strap. It's perfect, Amy. Thank you. Where on earth did you find it? I asked.
Well, she said, there's an online shop that makes them custom to order, but they also had some ready-made, and this was one of them. I fell in love with her, and I just had to buy her for you.
I placed the doll carefully on the coffee table next to the huge, shiny card decorated with tiny baby grows on a washing line, then leaned forward in my chair and wrapped my arms around Amy. She patted me on the back, leaning over my protruding baby bump to embrace me. I wish I'd had a bump that neat when I was 8 months pregnant, said Sumera. I was out here, she demonstrated with her hands, and we all laughed. I keep thinking that one day I'll wake up and be the size of a house, I said, laughing with them. I'd been active before the pregnancy. Running had helped me deal with the grief, and I'd been at the height of my fitness during the early stages of my pregnancy. I still felt some of that strength in my body. I certainly didn't feel weak or encumbered. I did get some of the classic symptoms of being heavily pregnant, like swollen ankles and needing to pee twice as much, but I was a far cry from the comedic elephant-sized pregnant women you see on the television. Not once had I burst into tears at work, and I'd managed to get through the last 8 months without craving pickles too. Oh, we're going to miss you around here, Price Hewitt, Trisha said, pulling me into another hug. I'm going to miss you guys too. Don't get too attached to my replacement, because I'll be back before you know it. You take your time, Angela said. Don't rush it. Enjoy your time with the baby. I nodded, taking in her words. No one mentioned Aiden. No one acknowledged that this was my second child. I bit my lip and fought against the rising tide of guilt threatening to take hold. Jake will be waiting for me. I stood a little too fast and felt the blood rush into my head. My joints ached a little, but the kindness of my colleagues had bolstered my energy levels, and I felt strong enough to take on the world. I was ready for the next challenge ahead, especially with Jake waiting for me in the car park. He had been my rock through the bad times, there with an outstretched hand to catch me when I fell. And believe me, I fell a lot. Call us when the baby's born. We all want to meet her, Amy said. She bit her lip, and I could see her mind whirring with thoughts of my lost boy, the one who'd walked away from her classroom and never come back. Yes, bring the little one into work, won't you? It's been ages since I had a cuddle with a newborn. My Oliver's nearly three now, if you can believe it, said Trisha, her eyes misty with thoughts of her grandson. Of course, I replied. I can't wait for you all to meet her. I bundled up the cards and presents into a plastic bag and picked up the large bunch of roses, with the price carefully peeled away from the packaging. We stood awkwardly near the door, and for the first time I saw hesitation on their faces. I saw contemplation, and I knew what they were all thinking about. Amy brushed tears away from her cheeks. We might not have mentioned Aiden's existence. We might have all made the unconscious decision to not utter his name while we celebrated the new baby. But Aiden was close, so close. I could almost see him standing in the shadows next to the pigeonholes and the corner table. He was in Amy's tears, and in the tentative smile on Sumera's face. He was in my heart, buried in my arteries, mixed into my blood and my DNA, and every atom that made me me. I said my goodbyes and made my way down the steps and out into the car park, the same car park I had run through that terrible day when my Wellington boot had sloshed through the rainwater and my sock hung precariously from my toes. Then I saw the silver Audi and Jake's smiling face in the driver's seat. How did it go? He asked, as I piled the presents and flowers into the back seat. We'd need to sort the baby seat out soon, I mused. It was only 3 weeks until my due date, and there was so much to be done. Good. You should see the gorgeous doll Amy bought for Bump. Jake frowned. You look wiped out. I was going to suggest we go for some tea to celebrate, but I think you need a warm bath and an early night. Shall we order in from Da Vinci's instead? I leaned across the gear stick to plant a soppy kiss on Jake's cheek. That sounds perfect. As we pulled out of the car park, I couldn't help but turn and give the school building one last look. I've been working there for 5 years now, and I should have been used to the sight of the old Victorian building by now, yet somehow today it brought all those feelings rushing back to the surface. And then she kicked. I clutched my belly and felt the second kick. Yes, I know you're there. There's room in my heart for you too. Chapter 3. Bishop Town School is a primary and secondary school in one. They added a newer building to the back of the old Victorian building about 20 years ago. Kids under 11 are taught in the older building at front, and kids from year 7 upwards study in the newer block behind. I met Jake when I was one of those kids. He was my teacher. It sounds creepy. It isn't. Jake started at Bishoptown just before I started studying for my GCSEs, but he didn't teach me until I started my A-levels. He was an art teacher, and I was an art student. He was young, only 28, and had just moved up to Bishoptown from a small town outside Brighton. Of course, I noticed he was gorgeous back then. We called him Handsome Hewitt. But I was far too enamoured with my own beau, Rob, to give my teacher a second glance. And then Aidan came along. 6 years ago, I was a mess. I hadn't worked properly since Aidan's death, aside from a part-time job in a supermarket, and I survived solely on the inheritance Mum and Dad left me after they died in a car crash. It was Jake who sought me out, who got me a job in the school, who pulled me out of the pit of darkness, and showed me that it was possible to turn on a light switch and save my own life. Finding him, or rather, him finding me, convinced me that I wasn't cursed after all, just unfortunate enough to lose my son and my parents in less than 4 years. I owed Jake all that I had. As we pulled into the driveway to our house, I glanced across at my husband and let my eyes drink him in. Despite being 10 years older than me, he was still attractive in a distinguished way. His wrinkles and greying hair didn't matter so much. It delighted me that he dressed like a typical teacher, with corduroy blazers and patterned ties. On him it looked trendy and sexy, not dowdy like some of the aging geography teachers at the school. He noticed my searching gaze and flashed me a questioning look. "What is it?" "Nothing," I shrugged, smiling. The stressful afternoon washed away and was replaced by a feeling akin to real happiness. Sure, I'd had glimpses of happiness over the last decade, but they'd never remained, not like the spreading feeling I was getting now. Could it be that my life was coming together? Was my happiness overtaking my grief for Aidan and my parents? They say that time is a great healer, but I never believed them. I considered myself irrevocably broken after the flood. But it seemed that at last, those pieces were binding together. Or so I thought. Jake carried the presents into the house, and I poured water into a vase and trimmed the stems of the roses. The kitchen came alive with the sounds of our movements, and the plastic bags rustled as Jake put the presents on the dining table. He began unpacking them one by one. "Was Jane there?" he asked. "No, she's hurt her back."
"Again?"
He shook his head.
"I guess that's what you get when you let yourself get into that state. How does she do it?"
I bristled at his callous remark. Jane was middle-aged and overweight. She'd missed half the previous term with constant health issues. It was hard not to think that most of her problems would disappear if she'd just lose the weight. But Jake had a brain-to-mouth problem sometimes. He said what other people didn't dare to. She twisted her back, putting her bra on. Jake let out a loud guffaw.
"You're kidding."
"Hey," I said, "it's hard putting your bra on when your skin's all damp from the shower."
"Yeah, but still."
He shook his head and carried on removing the presents from the bag.
"So, Amy bought you this doll then. And you like it?"
He held the box up with a delicate doll inside. "Yeah, why?"
"You don't think it's a bit creepy?"
He lifted the package higher as I stood with my hip resting against the kitchen counter, scissors in one hand and a rose in the other. His fingers dug into the plastic, and I wanted to tell him to stop squeezing it like that. The plastic crackled as he moved it about, setting my teeth on edge. When he put it down, the tension abated, and I managed to laugh.
"Are you one of those people who cried when they had a clown at a birthday party?"
Jake pushed his glasses further up his nose and gave a half-smile. "Only psychopaths find clowns funny. It's a fact. Just look at John Wayne Gacy." I shivered as I popped the final rose in place and gathered up the wrapping from the flowers, the trimmings caught within the folds.
"Don't forget to wipe the side down,"
Jake said, nodding towards the slight puddle of water I'd left on the counter. I rolled my eyes but collected a tea towel from the rack to soak up the mess. It was a running joke that Jake had needed to train me up to pick up after myself when we first moved in together. He said he used to coach me with praise and slight nudges in the right direction. If I'd been good, he'd take me out for dinner. For the first 6 months, I hardly noticed at all. I'd never been concerned with mopping up a little spilled water or picking up my socks from the night before, not until I shared a living space with a neat freak like Jake. Perhaps I'd been coddled too much by my parents after Aiden died. After all, I did remain living with them until they died. Then, when things became serious with Jake, I sold my parents' cottage and moved into Jake's luxurious three-bedroom property on Fox Lane, a stone's throw from the school. It was the opposite of my parents' higgledy-piggledy cottage. My parents' place was as quaint as an English cottage could get, with a thatched roof and narrow stairs filled with piles of books and old pieces of art. Jake's house was colourless and neat. The ceilings were high and airy. My parents' house had been painted in various shades of reds and browns, with low ceilings, but plenty of windows to let in light. The kitchen had been filled to bursting point with cast iron pans hanging from the beams and stacks of letters on top of the fridge. Jake's kitchen was minimalist and stark, with white modern cupboards and a hidden fridge. I set the roses on the table and took a step back, thinking how it was nice to have some colour in the kitchen for a change. Sometimes I missed the red walls of my old bedroom and the patterned duvets that inevitably lay in a tangled heap at the bottom of my bed. These days I slept, or rather tossed and turned, on crisp Egyptian cotton sheets in either ivory or white. "Let's go and sit on the sofa and watch a box set." Jake wrapped an arm around me and led me gently toward the living room. "Don't you want to read my card?" "Oh, yeah, of course," he said enthusiastically. "Bring it with you. How have you been today? Any back pain?" I almost laughed out loud. Of course there was back pain and ankle pain, and then there was the baby ramming her foot against my internal organs. When I was pregnant with Aiden, I'd been really squeamish about the thought of my baby sharing space with my kidneys and intestines, and everything else squashed alongside the womb, especially when I learned that the body moves and adapts to make room for the baby. This time around, I'd been determined to embrace all the joys of being pregnant. That had lasted until my first bout of morning sickness. "No more than usual," I settled into the sofa. Despite my bravado, I was tired from all the fuss. It was nice to take the weight off my feet. In fact, I probably wouldn't want to get up again now, unless I needed the loo. I passed the card to Jake. "It makes me sad reading this," Jake said. He stuck out a lip, imitating a pout. "Why? I mean, I know John in the history department read the card wrong and wrote sympathies, but everyone else is happy for us. I hope he read the card wrong anyway. Maybe he just feels very strongly about people bringing more children into the world." My little joke turned sour in my mouth as I said the word children. It's still there, that bitterness. For a long time, I couldn't look at other people's children. I couldn't even say the word. I stared down at my bump and tried to force those feelings away. It was time to be able to say a joke and enjoy it. "Because we wouldn't be working together for the next year. I won't be taking you to work and bringing you home. I'd wish I could take the year off with you. I mean, would it be so crazy? Would it be terrible?" "Might be if you want to eat," I replied. "You'd have to quit your job completely. They aren't going to let you take the year off, not both of us anyway." "I know, but what are you going to do all day?" "Well, I think this one will keep me busy." I laughed and pointed to my baby bump. But when I saw the tense line of his jaw and the way he gripped the card, I leaned across the sofa and held his forearm. "I know there's going to be a lot of change happening in our lives, but it's for a wonderful reason. You and I have created life. And we're going to have the opportunity to watch that wonderful life be born and grow up." My voice cracked, and I steadied myself before continuing. "This is our new beginning." Jake let go of the card and wrapped his fingers around my hand. "You're right. Our new life together. I'm sorry I got freaked out." I shook my head and squeezed his arm. I truly believed every word I said. There was a dark part of me filled with bitterness and grief. I could not deny that, but the rest of me was hopeful and strong, filled with the optimism of a new baby and a new life. My thoughts were interrupted by the ringing of our house phone.
Shall I get that?
Jake was half standing, but I pulled him back onto the sofa and pushed myself onto my feet. No, I want to stand up and move around a little. I think I'm getting cramp again. I walked over to the phone and picked up the receiver. Hello?
Miss Price. Emma. My name is DCI Stevenson, Carl Stevenson. Do you remember me?
The sound of his voice burst a bubble inside me, and all the air left my body. I deflated. Feeling myself double over, the room seemed to collapse around me, narrowing into nothing but the rushing blood in my ears and the narrow spot of light by the telephone. Yes. I remember you. My voice was breathless, only slightly louder than a whisper. Of course I remembered him. I gulped in a breath before I said, You were D.I. Stevenson then, though. My heart beat against my ribs. Da-dum. Da-dum.
That's right.
He paused. Emma, you need to come to St. Michael's Hospital as soon as you can.
Da-dum. Da-dum.
Breathless again. Why?
Because I think we've found Aiden.
Chapter 4. I've spent my fair share of time disorientated in hospitals. When I was 5, I came to visit my dying granddad and wandered away to find a vending machine. A nurse found me curled in a corner with my arms wrapped around my knees, crying about the scary balloons that everyone carried. They were the fluid bags from their IV drips. There was Aiden's birth 16 years ago. The nurse kept telling me I was lucky to be such a young mum, at least I'd get my figure back. Try having a kid when you're 40, she kept saying. Then there was the car accident. Mum was in a coma for a week before passing, but Dad's death had been instantaneous after he flew through the windscreen when the brakes failed on the M1. Their accident had caused a traffic jam of over 3 hours that day. Twitter had been filled with angry commuters lambasting my father's death because it made them late for work. But I still remember negotiating those twists and turns around the hospital, failing to remember which ward the nurse said, or finding out that they'd moved her to a different ward. The abbreviations made my head spin. ICU, A&E, CPR, DNR. The truth is that I was relieved when Mum finally passed. By that point, the doctors were uncertain whether she would ever regain her mental faculties after the trauma she had suffered, and I didn't want to be the one to tell her that Dad had died. At least this way, they both slipped away together. In just one moment, I lost my clever mother and my caring father, like the moment I lost my curious son. As I burst through the door into the pediatric ward in St. Michael's Hospital, a shiver ran down my spine. I knew in my heart that I had found my son. In one mere moment, what had been lost was found again. Moments are what make this life, aren't they? A life is built on moments, seconds passing by. Some seconds are fleeting, part of a silly dream or chopping up vegetables, taking the rubbish out, trimming our nails. Some are not. Detective Carl Stevenson sat on a small bench in a tiny room on the right of the ward corridor. He rose to his feet, polystyrene cup in one hand, as I approached, Jake following behind me, and opened his mouth to speak. I didn't let him.
Where is he?
I blurted out. Is it him?
Emma, he said, doing away with formalities. We need to talk. Take a moment and sit down. I want to explain everything to you first.
I regarded his dark brown eyes and salt-and-pepper beard, more salt since the last time we'd met, and wondered how on earth he supposed I could sit down at a moment like this. There was a chance. My son was back from the dead. God, just thinking about it was insane. This was all insane, and yet...
Love, think of the baby, Jake said.
He's right. Sit down and listen to the detective.
I need to know. I said, I need to see him.
What would a 16-year-old Aiden look like? Would he have bum fluff on his chin like the kids at school? Would he be tall and lanky or short and stocky? Would he look like me or Rob? I shut my thoughts down, What if it wasn't him at all? What if this was all some sort of mistake? It was the most logical explanation to everything.
I know, Stevenson said. But you need to take a breath. Agent, the young boy we found has been through significant trauma and is very sensitive at the moment. The doctor will explain more in a moment, but I wanted to talk to you first. I thought you might remember me from the investigation after the flood.
I do, I said.
After we realized Aidan was missing, search and rescue scoured the surrounding area for him. The River Ouse was searched, the woods were searched, the village was searched. But there was no sign of him. There was no body either. The experts explained to me that when someone drowns in a flood, they do not float downstream like many people believe. They actually sink underneath turbulent water, where it is calmer, and then they rise to the top very close to where they drowned. But there was no body. Aidan was never found. That was when Detective Stevenson had been assigned, because there was a slim chance that Aidan had not drowned at all. I sat down on the bench as a group of three nurses walked down the corridor on our left. I thought they were staring at me, possibly wondering if I was here to claim the missing boy, like a leftover sock after a PE lesson. My hands formed into fists and I clutched at the cotton dress I was wearing. It was damp from the rain outside. I hadn't even put on a coat. I'm listening, I said. A teenage boy was found wandering along the back road between Bishoptown Village and Rough Valley Forest. A couple were heading out of the village and came across him. He was wearing only a pair of jeans, no top or shoes. He was muddy all over. They stopped and asked the boy where he was going. They said he acknowledged their questions but didn't speak. He stopped walking, looked at them, and maintained eye contact, but he did not reply. They managed to get him into their car and drove him to the nearest police station. I let out a long breath, only at that moment realizing that I had been holding my breath at all. The baby adjusted her weight inside me, kicking me as she moved. I placed my palm on my bump, barely registering the movement. "What happened next?" I asked. My colleagues at the station ran through a list of missing persons in the area, but the boy didn't match anyone in the system. Then they took a DNA sample. Stevenson paused and ran his hands along his jeans. He'd been called in, I realized. He wasn't in the smart suit I remembered from that horrible week when we searched for Aidan. Do you remember that we put Aidan's DNA on file after his disappearance?
Yes, I replied.
I had scraped up as much of his hair as I could and sent in items of clothing with dried blood on them for the police to use. Aidan was always scraping his knees or picking at a scab, and I had never been particularly good at keeping on top of the washing. The boy was clearly distressed. He wouldn't speak to any of my colleagues at the station, so they brought him to the hospital. A DNA test was run yesterday and the analysis came back a few hours ago. The teenage boy in that room is Aidan. I unclenched my fists, let out a shallow breath, and clenched my hands again. How could this be happening? How? A tingling sensation spread over my body from my scalp to the bottom of my feet. Are you all right, Miss Price? Can I get you anything? I vaguely heard Jake's reply. It's Mrs. Price Hewitt now, I'm married. I apologize. Emma, can you hear me?
Yes,
I whispered. I closed my eyes and leaned against the wall behind me. My thoughts swam with Stevenson's words. DNA, teenage boy, Rough Valley Forest. Was it all real? I realized Stevenson had been right to take me aside and explain all this to me. I needed to compose myself. If I was going to step into that room and face Aidan for the first time in 10 years... I declared you dead, I thought. I'm okay, I said. I'm fine, this is all quite a shock, as you can imagine. Can I see him now? I need to see him. I'll chat with the doctor. Stevenson offered a taut smile and rose to his feet.
It can't be true,
Jake said after Stevenson had left the room.
It's been 10 years, where has he been?
I bet the police have bungled something. They'll have got the DNA test wrong or something.
What if they haven't? I said.
But if it really is him, Jake, I'll have my son back.
Jake wrapped his arm around my shoulders and squeezed. I just don't want you to get your hopes up, love. I'd hate for you to be heartbroken all over again. Remember how long it took you to deal with Aiden's death.
I know, I said.
And the truth was that my heart was still closed. I hadn't even realized it. I thought I was so open and raw, but I wasn't. I was closed up and shriveled inside. I rose to my feet when the doctor came to speak to us and found myself dwarfed by his height. The man's kind face and open eyes helped to relieve some of the tension that had built up in my chest.
Mrs. Price Hewitt, my name is Dr. Schaefer. I'm the head of the paediatric ward here at St. Michael's. There are a few things I want to mention before you go in to see your son. I've been briefed by DCI Stevenson here, so I understand the delicate nature of this situation. Your son, Aiden, has been through some trauma. He is currently still in shock from whatever that trauma is, and for that reason we have not completed a full examination. We're trying to space out each procedure to keep him calm and happy. But right now we can say that he is healthy. He is smaller than most 16-year-olds, and we will need to look into why that is. He has remained mute since his arrival, but he does understand what we are saying, and he is happy watching cartoons or children's television shows. But please, don't feel disheartened if he doesn't react when you first see him. The blood drained from my face. What if he didn't recognize me? I reached out for Jake's hand and he clasped it with his own.
Thank you, Dr. Schaefer, I said with an unsteady voice.
The doctor smiled and led the way down the corridor. I followed with shaky steps, trying desperately to walk with my back straight and tall, keeping one hand on my pregnant stomach, attempting to soothe my unborn child and soothe myself at the same time. My heart worked double time, pumping and pounding like a dribbled basketball. The hospital walls closed in on me as claustrophobia seeped into my veins, constricting my chest so that I had to remind myself to take deep breaths. I gripped Jake's fingers so hard that it must have caused him pain, but he didn't flinch or complain. And then we reached the room. The doctor paused and waited for me to nod. He opened the door. In that most mundane of actions, I had one of those moments, the kind you remember for a lifetime, the kind that slow down and leave a permanent imprint on your mind.
Chapter 5. There was nothing remarkable about the boy in the hospital room. He was propped up by pillows on the bed, with a pigeon chest poking up inside blue pajamas. I never found out who bought him those pajamas. I suspected it was DCI Stevenson. The boy had straggly brown hair that hung lankly down to the collar of his pajama top. He sat with his fingers clutching hold of the bedsheets, his gaze fixed on the tiny hospital television. I took a tentative step forward, following the doctor but barely aware of anyone else in the room except the boy in the bed, whose head turned in my direction and stopped my heart. He had Rob's eyes. My Aiden. The little boy I nursed as a baby had also had Rob's eyes. They were chestnut brown with a hint of hazel near the pupil. A multitude of photographs popped into my head. Aiden's first birthday, the time he smeared strawberry mousse all over his hands and face, bath time, bedtime stories, sitting on Nana's lap with Grandpa pulling faces, jumping up and down in puddles, all with a big grin across his face and those shining, chestnut brown eyes.
How do we know the DNA test was correct? I heard Jake say. How do we know there wasn't some sort of ball up?
There wasn't,
I whispered, utterly certain that it was Aiden sitting in front of me. It's unlikely, answered DCI Stevenson. But to be sure, I was going to suggest that we test his DNA against Emma's. That way we'll know 100% that this is Aiden Price.
I buried you, I thought. With my gaze holding my son's in my heart, I put you to rest. Can you ever forgive me?
Do I even deserve forgiveness? Mothers are supposed to never give up. In the movies, when the child is missing, the mother always knows they are alive. They would feel it if the child were dead. That connection, that magical connection between mother and child would be cut, and there was supposed to be a sensation that came along with it. But I'd seen Aiden's red anorak pulled from the river ooze, and I'd assumed he was dead. I bit my lip to hold back the tears. "Aiden," I said, stepping towards the bed. I smiled at the boy with the dark brown hair and small chin. My old, withered heart skipped a beat when it hit me that he was so small, not much bigger than a 12-year-old, with eyes that seemed too big for his face. "Don't panic if he doesn't react," said Dr. Schaefer. "We believe he's listening and taking everything in, but it will take some time for him to process whatever has happened to him. Would you like to sit down, Mrs. Price-Hewitt?" I nodded and moved my body accordingly as the doctor pulled a chair close to Aiden's bed. But as I was sitting, all I could think about was what had happened to my boy. Where had he been? A decade. 10 years. Wars were fought and lost in a decade. Prime ministers and presidents came and went. Important scientific discoveries were made, and all that time, my boy, my child, had been missing from the world. Missing from my world, at least. Nudging the chair forward, I leaned towards him and let my hand hover a centimetre above his. Aiden stared down at my hand, frowned, and pulled his away. "He's not keen on physical contact at the moment," explained Dr. Schaefer. I tried to ignore the pain those words caused and withdrew my hand to place it on my lap. Twice I opened my mouth to speak, but twice I closed it again. There was a Transformers cartoon blaring out through the room, interrupting the hanging silence, but even so, the atmosphere was electric. "Aiden, do you remember me?" I said in a croaky voice. "Do you know who I am?" He blinked. He was so still, it was terrifying. The little boy I had known was never still. And even though I knew instantly that this boy with the chestnut brown eyes was my son, I was having difficulty associating the curious 6-year-old chatterbox with this soulful, mute young man. I injected some cheer into my voice in a pathetic attempt to lighten the mood. "I'm your mum. We lost each other for a while, but I'm back now, and I'm going to make sure you're safe, okay?" I blinked rapidly and took a deep breath, trying desperately to quell the rising tide of emotions threatening to sweep me away. "Once you're feeling better, you can come home with me, and we can get to know each other again. Does that sound okay?" There was not even a trace of a smile on his lips. His eyes slowly turned back to the television, and I longed to wrap my arms around his narrow shoulders and hold him close to me. I turned to the doctor in panic. I don't know what to do. Despite my efforts to hold back my tears, a sob escaped, breaking through the noisy cartoon and jolting me back to reality. Aiden didn't need me to break down. He needed me to be strong, not a dithering wreck. "You're doing great," Dr. Schaefer encouraged. "Try to keep talking to him. We want Aiden to hear the sound of his mother's voice." I took a deep breath and steadied myself. Aiden smelled like disinfectant and eggs. My gaze trailed over to the small table next to his bed. There was a colouring book, but no toys, no presents or flowers. My boy should have gifts. I would come back with gifts, and he would be Aiden again. He'd be the bright, colourful and creative little boy I used to know. I took a deep breath and closed my eyes. There he was, walking up through the school car park on his way to class with a Power Rangers rucksack and his bright red coat. I opened my eyes and pretended I was talking to that same boy. "Do you like the cartoon, Aiden? I remember when you were little and you had a Transformer car. Do you remember that? It was red and it turned into a robot. You used to play games where the robot went to war against your stuffed toys. You'd got a bit too big for your rabbit and teddy bears. You liked robots and cars and Power Rangers.
like most little boys your age. But you like drawing too. You used to draw the most wonderful pictures for me. They weren't stick figures either. They were proper, coloured-in, gorgeous pictures of me and Nana and Grandpa.